When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tortoise.
Hello, I'm Giles Whittell. I'm Tortoise's deputy editor. It's the week ending Friday, the 12th of April. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
U.S. President Joe Biden is vowing ironclad support for Israel as Iran threatens to launch a retaliatory strike.
Newsroom O.J. Simpson, the former football star who was accused of killing his ex-wife and her boyfriend, has died.
In the past few minutes, a court in Vietnam has sentenced a wealthy property developer to death for defrauding a bank of billions of dollars.
Ruling, Arizona's conservative Supreme Court declared that physicians are now on notice that all abortions are illegal.
To help me work out what should lead the news, I'm joined by Tortoise editors Kerry Thomas and Jess Winch. Hello.
Hi, Giles.
And by Zainab Badawi, author, broadcaster, president of SOAS at the University of London, and many, many other things. Zainab, your new book is An African History of Africa, and it's a heck of a book. And you make clear at the top of it that you've been practically everywhere to report it. So there's a lot of journalism in it, but it's proper history too. And we were talking just before we started about the Benin chapter. I can't resist reading a little bit. Do you mind?
No, of course.
All right.
Please.
I should really get you to.
No,
will you do me the favour of reading this description from 1641 by a Portuguese naval captain of Great Benin?
Sure. And I should just say Benin, of course, is in Nigeria, southern Nigeria, not the country, the Republic of Benin,
right.
We're talking about.
That bit down there.
So this is in 1691, the Portuguese naval captain Lourenço Pinto wrote, "Great Benin, where the king resides, is larger than Lisbon. All the streets run straight as far as the eye can see. The houses are large, especially that of the king, which is richly decorated and has fine columns. The city is wealthy and industrious. It is so well governed that theft is unknown, and the people live in such security that they have no doors to their houses."
That's amazing to me. And then 200 years later, the Brits come along and sack the place. And the overall theme of the book, perhaps, is that for too long we've absorbed, well, here in the West, Western histories of Africa, and you try to sort of put that straight. Admittedly, that's a Portuguese account, but of an Africa that I think many people just have no idea existed. I mean, where in all your travels were you most struck by the sort of the deficit of African history that you were trying to put straight?
I mean, frankly, Giles, all over the continent, there's a dearth of knowledge about pre-colonial Africa. And actually, sadly, also inside Africa itself, let alone outside of the continent. It seems to many people that Africa's history begins with the European presence. And, of course, that's not the case at all. And in the 18 chapters in my book, it's only in chapter 14 that I begin with the transatlantic slave trade, and subsequently those chapters do look at the presence of the Europeans and the detrimental impact of their activities on the continent. So I was very keen to ensure that people understood that Africa, which is after all where everybody came from, it's the oldest continent, or the oldest continent in terms of the human presence, actually has the longest history. And yet, ironically, it's the shortest in most people's minds. I think if you said to most people, name a couple of kings or queens of Africa, I should think most people would say Tutankhamun. They'd be hard-pressed to give him a date. And I'm not sure they'd come up with many more names. So it is that level of ignorance that I wanted to tackle in the book. But for me also, who is telling the story of Africa's history was just as important, which is why it's called An African History of Africa, because my sources are predominantly of African historians, archaeologists, anthropologists. And it seems to me that they have been denied their rightful place on the global intellectual stage.
Even right back at the beginning, I should say that the book opens with the clearest account that I've ever read of the out of Africa migration, in which you call Lucy the fossil by her proper name, which is...
Lucy's name in Amharic is Dinkanesh, which means you are marvellous. And not Lucy, because that was the name given to her by the paleontologists who discovered her remains, because Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was being played on the camp radio, and hence she was called Lucy. But in Ethiopia, she's called Dinkanesh, and that's how I prefer to refer to her. And that's just one very small example of how you have to view Africa's history through an African lens, because I think only in that way can you accord people the respect of them relating their own history and not having it told by outsiders or denigrated or being told that they don't have any history.
And we're going to talk, I think, in a bit about a piece of African contemporary history, if you like. But I wanted to ask before we move on, because you're also a journalist.
I am.
Increasingly, especially at the BBC and places that can afford it, news organisations are hiring locally, and we get coverage of Africa more from people who know it, who live there, who've grown up there, rather than reporters parachuted in. I mean, that must be in and of itself a good thing, but do you have a sense of how it's changing the nature of the coverage and the stories that are selected that make it onto bulletins over here?
I think it's only a good thing that you no longer have somebody flown in from London when a story breaks out in Africa, and that you are relying on local or at least regional journalists. You know, they speak the same language as the people who are affected by the stories that they are covering. And that's super important. I do think that when you, as a journalist, have a first-hand experience of the community in which you're reporting, it does give you more insights. And I found this when I was actually researching my book, because it came out of a TV series called The History of Africa with Zainab Badawi, which I made for the BBC, 20, 45-minute films. And I was urged by some people to take a film crew with me from the UK. And I said, no, I'm going to use local crews wherever I go. So in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, I use Congolese, you know, crews in Ghana, the same, et cetera, et cetera. And I found that actually I had much better access, much better understanding. So if I'm filming somebody and behind the camera or wielding the sound, the microphone, it is a local person, the person I'm interviewing is much more at ease. You know, they're not intimidated by some foreigner stomping around their home or whatever, asking, you know, behind the lens. So I think it's a no-brainer, isn't it, really? And I think it does lead to more sensitive coverage. I wonder to what extent it would be even better if you had people in the centre of news stations, you know, the editors, the foreign editors, also reflecting a very diverse mix of staff. And that, I think, is still a bit lacking, which means that still there is a tendency to see stories in Africa, again, through a kind of UK-centric or Eurocentric lens. And the person working out in the field still has to respond to that to some extent. So you still get the coup, war, famine syndrome in coverage of Africa. And, you know, look, the local stringer or the local reporter can't really say, no, I'm not going to cover that story. But actually, I do hear of people pushing back and saying, you know, there is a different way of covering this story.
Fascinating. All right, well, let's get started with the show. And that means with long stories short. So in a headline or a sentence, you have to tell me what story you think should lead the news. Jess, you go first.
If you want something done, ask 2,000 Swiss women.
Very nice. Kerry.
I want to do hate speech and how to deal with it.
And Zainab.
15th of April marks a year since the war in Sudan between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces broke out. 13,000 dead, 8 million displaced, millions on the brink of famine, and there's not enough being done about it.
And maybe not enough discussed about it, just for starters. Okay, thank you very much. Jess, let's start with you. Tell us a bit more about your story, the 2,000 Swiss women.
2,000 Swiss women. Well, normally, I don't know if you've noticed, I tend to bring quite grim, depressing stories to the news meeting.
And you always win with them.
Well, I bring them because I think they matter. And that's because there's usually, they're looking at people who need help. But why I think this story should lead the news this week and why I love it is I think it is an inspiring story because it shows you how ordinary people can affect significant change. And that's especially true when you're faced with a challenge like climate change, which can often feel so hard to tackle when you're looking at it as an individual. So what happened is that in 2016, 2,000 Swiss women, all aged 64 and above, filed a case in the Swiss courts saying that the Swiss authorities had not done enough to protect them from the effects of climate change. And their age is important because as elderly women, they are more vulnerable to heat-related illnesses. And so we're more vulnerable from the effects of climate change. And the Swiss courts...
And we know that, do we? There's sort of peer-reviewed research that shows that.
There is peer-reviewed research that shows that heat-related mortality is higher in women generally than in men, particularly in older age groups. Exactly why that is isn't always clear. There's been, for example, some suggestion that because men sweat more easily than women, they can obviously get rid of excess heat more easily, that women often might be more isolated. If they live longer than men, they might be more likely to live alone and therefore more vulnerable. So the effect is that the reason is not entirely clear, but it is accepted, and the Swiss authorities accepted that elderly women were more vulnerable from the effects of climate change and more vulnerable to heat. So, but after the Swiss courts had rejected their case, they took it to the European Court of Human Rights in 2020. And on Tuesday, that court, which is the highest human rights courts in Europe, agreed with them. They found that the Swiss authorities had not acted in time or in an appropriate way to devise and implement laws to mitigate the effects of climate change. And that was a violation of the women's rights. Because you've got to remember, Switzerland, along with all so many other countries, all signed up to the Paris Agreement in 2015, where they pledged to take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to keep global temperatures to up to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures. This court found that Swiss authorities have not been doing enough to keep to that promise, had been held up for it.
So let's just suppose that the Swiss government doesn't appeal.
Can't appeal. There's no appeal at this stage.
Okay. So what does the ruling require the Swiss government to do?
Nothing. And that's important. So this ruling does not oblige the Swiss government to do anything specific. The court can't say to the Swiss government, you must do this, this, and this, because that's up to the Swiss government to decide among itself with the Swiss population as to how they're going to do with it. What this ruling does is say that in not taking timely and effective action like you promised and like you say you're doing, you are violating the human rights of this group of women. So it's seen in that sense. This is the first time that an international court has ruled on climate change. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that a court has confirmed that countries have an obligation to protect the people within their jurisdictions from the effect of climate change. And it's seen as a pathway for other climate litigation coming through the courts, which is happening more and more, I think, as people feel that the governments, having said one thing, are not actually doing what's necessary to uphold it.
Okay. Zainab, is this a big deal for you?
I loved this story, actually. And what was really super was how surprised the women themselves were. One of them kept on saying, I feel like I'm in a dream or something. But what I particularly like about it is that it was women 64 years and above, because so often we associate climate change campaigners and activists with, you know, the Greta Thunbergs of this world, because they are the ones who are going to suffer the most in years to come. But what I like about this is it shows that it's an urgent and pressing problem for these women with the heat waves. And, you know, it's akin to, if you lived in Beijing, wouldn't you want to do something about climate change now? Because it's just so unpleasant to walk around with all these noxious fumes, or in cities in Indonesia and so on and so forth. So I think it's not the kind of idea that this is something which is going to affect posterity. It is something which is affecting us now, and it just reinforces that idea. And I think it's also good to show that the courts are involved for the first time, as you said, Jessica, because it shows how commitments, pledges to climate change should be legally binding.
And I should say as well, the court rejected two other similar cases on the same day, which is just important to mention. So one, which was brought by a French mayor, was thrown out because he no longer lives in France or in that jurisdiction. The other one, which I've mentioned before on a previous episode of the News Meeting, was brought by a number of Portuguese young people. So yes, the sort of more well-known end of the climate activist spectrum. And that was thrown out because they hadn't gone through the Portuguese courts first. And also because they were trying to take action against 33 countries, not just Portugal. And again, the court said, no, that's, you can't do that.
Kerry, would this have made the top of the Today programme? And will it make a difference to anything, do you think?
Well, I think, as Zainab says, I think the interesting thing about it is it feels as if it could open up a whole bunch of other class actions against governments, doesn't it? That although the young people's case got thrown out yesterday, it's not difficult to think that you could mount a successful case on behalf of young people based on different criteria than the Swiss women had, but for the length of time that they will have to live with the consequences of climate change obviously opens up a potentially different avenue. Prince Andrew, who can't sweat, maybe he could maybe there's a whole different legal case there, you know? So I do think it does feel, even if this one doesn't have a particular effect, that it could be an interesting doorway for legal actions, class actions that could have a real bearing in the future.
Mm. Of course, until you actually require big governments to impose stricter emissions controls, nothing changes, and poor old Switzerland's beautiful glaciers continue to retreat rather quickly.
But we've got quite used to the idea that actually it's companies and finance markets that are making the running on climate change legislation, and if forces the ball back into the government's courts, that's probably no bad thing, is it?
Right. Okay, let's move on. Thank you, Jess. Kerry, tell us more about your story. Pretty involved, I think.
No, not at all, you know me. So there were really two stories yesterday that had to do with so-called hate speech that caught my eye, and I think it's possible to see a sort of link between the two. So we had the CAS review into gender identity services at the Tavistock in London, which the headline on which was that puberty blockers and so on will no longer be available on the NHS to children. But within the CAS review, there was a section which went out of its way to note that the toxicity of the debate around gender identity in young people had contributed to the problems in that area, but actually in ways that weren't the usual ones. So what Hilary Cass said was that the debate was so toxic that it stopped medical professionals looking at children in the round, in effect. It stopped them considering whether depression, anxiety, undiagnosed autistic spectrum disorder and a whole range of other things prevented medical professionals looking beyond the simple question of gender identity for complex causes for whatever they were going through. It does seem quite extraordinary that was true, even though those debates were off limits, even within a hospital. On the same day, we had a report back from Police Scotland on week one of the Hate Crime and Public Order Act. Headline on that was that there'd been 7,000, just under 7,200 complaints of which only 240 were judged to be hate crimes. This is week one of the legislation, mm-hmm. so heavily trailed. 240 hate crimes and 30 what they call non-hate crimes, which didn't quite meet the threshold for criminality.
Non-hate crimes or non-crime hate incidents?
Non-crime hate incidents, you're right. So in the Cass review case, you've got a clear example of the problems that can be caused by the toxicity of a debate around a contentious subject. In the Police Scotland case, you've got, I think, what looks prima facie like a pretty flawed way of dealing with so-called hate mm-hmm. crimes and hate speech. But what I want to argue, I think, is that we should keep close tabs mm-hmm. on what happens with that legislation in Scotland. A single week is no amount of time at all to show whether this is, as reported, like a really flawed way of dealing with this, you know, very serious issue. I saw Fraser Nelson, the Spectator, saying that Scotland's become a laboratory for bad laws, and Lord Hope, a very senior Scottish law lord, agreeing with him. But it still doesn't mean, even so, that we shouldn't keep an eye on what happens right there. Because I think it's interesting whether it's good, bad or indifferent.
Well, like you say, a week is a very short time span by which to judge it. And I did notice that the vast bulk of the 7,000 plus initial deluge of complaints filed under the law related to J.K. Rowling and Hamza Yousef, both of whom had been deliberately, J.K. Rowling had been deliberately provocative on the day of, and Hamza Yousef had made a remark about the absence of, about how many Scottish leaders were white just before. And one would assume that that'll all tail off.
Yeah.
And it's quite possible, isn't it, that Scotland will emerge as the most civilised country in the world.
It may already be there, but I think it's definitely too soon to make a call on whether it's flawed. I mean, I think there are reasons to wonder about the framing of the legislation. So it really does two things. It says, did a person behave in a way that a responsible person would find threatening or abusive? Okay, that's a fairly standard sort of legal test. Where it goes beyond that, they said, did the person at the heart of his complaint behave in a way intended to stir up hatred against a group of people with a protected characteristic, so age, gender, disability, religious leaning, whatever? So the threshold is not the offence, but that a reasonable person would find the comment or the action threatening or abusive. And that's I think, seen as a more difficult and a vaguer kind of test. So stirring up hatred is quite a high bar, may not be the right one. Mm-hmm. You've already got a campaign saying that this law will have to be repealed in the fullness of time. But part of the hope for devolution was that it would allow different mm-hmm. parts of the UK to experiment, you know, much like you have in the States. And so if it's doing that, I still think it's an interesting one to keep an eye on over 1 year, 2 years, not just over 1 or 2 weeks.
But the question for us, Jess, is does it lead the news today? Kerry has pitched it as two stories about hate speech. Is it manageable as a sort of news commodity?
I think that's where I would struggle for it leading a story, is trying to take the Cass review and the Scottish law. And while they both cover a similar theme, I think trying to tie them together as a story is where you might run into trouble given the complexity of both areas. On the Scotland case, one thing that I was also interested in is it seems that an awful lot depends on how the police manage this and how they interpret this. And I've read that they've only had, I think, a 2-hour online training session. I'm not sure how that's seen as sufficient.
At most, I think.
So how they can be expected to make these kind of decisions. And as you say, I think a lot depends on how this plays out over a longer period.
Yeah, but I think actually to give credit to Police Scotland, to have got through 7,158 cases in a week and made firm decisions on them all, that's not bad going by the standards of most police forces.
But at the cost of what, though? Because, I mean, they're not providing extra police forces to assess cases, so you wonder if there's a cost there to investigating other forms of crimes.
Yeah, there must be, wasn't there? You can't allocate
sex-related crimes and all the rest of it. Because I think they have said that they are a bit inundated, haven't they? trying to assess.
So now, which of the two components of Kerry's story do you find more compelling? I mean, essentially, you're saying, aren't you, in relation to the Cass report, that it is saying that the toxicity of the debate around the health services offered to children left medical professionals feeling unable to explore broader issues or examine the children presenting in the, what's the phrase? In the round? Holistically.
Mm. I think in terms of which story would lead, I think the Scottish hate law would be, I think, one that is easier to... I mean, I still think my story, when I come to it, is going to be the one
By
that
the way, you're not allowed to choose your own.
Oh, I see, right, okay.
We get to that.
Well, I think it's just, you know, the transgender issue in young people is such a complex one and really ought to be taken on a, you know, case-by-case study, that I think to really give it the proper attention that it's due, I wouldn't like to see it reduced to, you know, perhaps oversimplifying the story. So I'd go with the Scottish hate one. Although, I mean, I struggle to see why we in the UK would need such a new law, because we've always known that hate speech is something which is not allowed. You can't stand up and start inciting violence against, you know, whoever it is. I mean, there are limits to freedom of speech and freedom of expression. You know, we have laws of defamation, laws of libel, and I mean, it's a month, the month that we're celebrating, not celebrating, but commemorating 30 years since the Rwanda genocide, where it was so clear that there was, you know, incitement to violence against certain groups of people. So I do wonder why Scotland felt they
had to introduce this. I think the suspicion is that it's politically motivated rather than philosophically motivated, that the SNP, you know, relies heavily on its appeal to younger people, and this is the kind of legislation that might play well there.
Right.
Maybe.
Okay, Kerry, thanks very much. Massive issues. We could obviously spend an hour on it. We don't have that time. So we now have to take a break, and then we'll hear from Zainab what she thinks should lead the news.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
So, Zainab, tell us about your story.
So, on April the 15th in 2023, a terrible conflict, war, broke out in Sudan, and it's the country where I was born. I've lived in the UK since I was two, but I've maintained contacts with the Sudan, of course, and the people there. And this is a war which has claimed at least 13,000 lives. The British government has said Darfur, which is a historic conflict, has flared up again and that there is renewed ethnic cleansing going on there. 8 or 9 million people have been displaced from their homes. And Martin Griffiths, who's the UN humanitarian chief, says that 800,000 children are facing severe malnutrition and 5 million people more are facing acute food shortages, bringing them to the brink of mass starvation. And this is a conflict which has been relegated really to the back pages, because obviously the Gaza conflict is on the front pages. In the middle pages is the Ukraine war, and this conflict in Sudan really is not getting the attention that it deserves. And you can see that, for example, in the sense that of the $2.7 billion which the UN has said is needed to address the humanitarian crisis, only 4% of that money that's needed has turned up. And it's interesting that President Emmanuel Macron of France, on the 15th of April, the day when the conflict broke out, is hosting a humanitarian pledging conference. And I say it's interesting that it's the French, because, of course, the British are the former colonial powers in Sudan, and I think they've been rather absent from the scene. Martin Griffiths, of course, at the UN is British, but he speaks much more in his capacity as a UN person. So there's this awful humanitarian conflict going on. So that's one strand of this conflict that's not getting due attention. And there is some food going in through Chad into Darfur, and people are now saying also let's get it in through South Sudan. But the capital, Khartoum, has been completely destroyed, which is where my family are mostly from. They're lucky because they have means. They've all fled to Egypt or the
when
Gulf.
You say the capital has been destroyed, if we bothered to look, would we see scenes like Gaza?
Completely and utterly. I mean, there are no hospitals that are working, and completely and utterly. I mean, relatives send me videos every now and again. I don't know how they obtain them, or pictures of their homes just completely ransacked. So the war is, of course, between the Sudan Armed Forces, the SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces. And, you know, the conflict is often depicted as one between the two warring generals. It isn't as such between two warring generals, because General Al-Burhan, Abdel Fattah Al-Burhan, who leads the Sudan Armed Forces, suppose something were to happen to him, there'd still be another general who would just come up. So it's the Sudan Armed Forces who have the vestiges of the state, and they're based in Port Sudan. That's where the government is. And Khartoum, the Sudan Armed Forces have moved from a defensive position to an offensive one now, trying to take on the Rapid Support Forces, which are led by General Hemeti. So there's that arm to the conflict, which is not really covered very much, the actual fighting going on the ground. There are some reporters who've gone in. And then the third strand is the efforts at trying to find a diplomatic solution to this. And a couple of months ago, the Americans appointed a special envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, and Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the US ambassador to the United Nations, is also trying to breathe some life into the negotiations. There are several strands of the negotiations, some being run in Saudi Arabia, some by the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD. And I think now there is an appetite for the external players who are involved and back different sides, like the United Arab Emirates, who are backing the Rapid Support Forces. Egypt has been behind the Sudan Armed Forces. I think there is an appetite now for these outside players to be brought in to the efforts to try and find a solution. And I think the French putting attention on it is very important, because they are saying, look, if this is not contained, Sudan borders 8 countries in Africa. It's going to spread, including in Chad, where, of course, France has a lot of interests and so on. So this is something which really could affect the stability of an entire continent.
Mm.
And in terms of the refugees and the internally displaced people, I mean, a lot of refugees have come here to Britain. It's a story which is of massive geostrategic importance. You also have the Russians, of course, involved on the ground with the Wagner Group, who've been supporting the rapid support forces. Russia, as a government traditionally, has been backing the Sudan armed forces. It's a real mess. And I just would love to see it on the front pages. And I would love Gary and Jessica to say, yes, we should lead on it.
Kerry, let's stipulate that it's a big story and it's underreported. Why is it underreported, and how do you put it back on the front pages?
I mean, it certainly is both those things. I don't have a good answer to why. I'm not sure I even agree with you, Zainab, that it's been sort of usurped by Gaza. I think it had disappeared from the front pages even before.
You're right.
October the 7th last year. So there's some deeper explanation rather than just that sort of Ukraine-Gaza pecking order. What's shaming now, I think, is the only time I really see reference to Sudan is when I see a league table of where Gaza sits on measures like famine and number of calories per day. And what you constantly see is the country that's worse than Gaza still is Sudan. And that's, you know, from memory, that's the majority of the coverage that it's had in recent times has been as a reference point for how awful Gaza is, rather than actually in its own right as a story.
I think you're absolutely right, actually. You've rightly corrected me that it had fallen off even before that. And I think we saw that in 2019 after Omar al-Bashir was toppled. Yes, sure, COVID happened. But the Sudanese are saying that this conflict started because there was not enough international focus on what comes after Omar al-Bashir. You know, sanctions were not lifted. There wasn't enough help. There was no peace dividend. And it left a vacuum which these two forces could exploit.
Jess, which element of it would you lead with if you were told this was leading? I mean, I'm very struck, for example, by the destruction of Khartoum.
We've not seen anything.
Picture
on
story in a headline right there.
Yeah. Well, the reason we should lead with it this week and possibly next week as well, it's the conference in Paris, because after a year of it being so underreported in so many ways, and there's been so much to unpack, this conference gives you a hook. It gives you a reason to write something now, which is sort of one of the news value tests. And I think it gives you a way into it if you wanted to do it as a preview ahead of time. And then you look at what comes out of it. And if you look already just at the numbers mentioned earlier, at a 4% of $2.7 billion requested so far, I hope that the summit next week manages to try and raise that percentage, but my hopes aren't that high of how much further it will go. And then that gives you a reason to look at why.
Okay. Those are the stories. Sudan, the women of Switzerland, hate speech in the UK. You have to tell me now which you would lead with. You can't choose your own. Jess?
I would lead with Sudan.
Kerry?
I might actually withdraw my story in favour of Sudan as well.
Hey, got your wish.
Zainab, you cannot choose your own, although you already tried to.
I think the women of Switzerland, if I can't choose Sudan, it would be the women of Switzerland. I think that's such a landmark case, and it's one we will refer to time and time again.
Okay, now I have to work out what I think. I love the women of Switzerland. I wish them all the best, but I am painfully aware that unless governments bigger than Switzerland act and act fast, for example, to bring forward rather than push back emissions controls or the phasing out of internal combustion engines, we're all up what is technically known as shit alley. Am I allowed to say that? Anyway, the hate speech story in the UK, Kerry, you're right, it will rumble on and on, and the Scottish law gives us a good lens through which to view it and the fortunes of Hamza Youssef and J.K. Rowling as they deliberately and not deliberately troll the Scottish population. But I think there's no question that the Sudan story leads. Not because of the anniversary, but as Jess says, because of the donor conference coming up, at which the gulf between what's needed and what's already been pledged is huge. And I think also, just one last point, One reason to run a big story big is if you have someone who knows about it on hand to tell you about it. And we do. Zainab, that was you today. Thank you very much. So that's the running order. That's it for this episode of the News Meeting. If you think there's a story we missed, then you can email us on newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. Jess and Kerry, thank you very much. And Zainab, principally, thank you. Your new book is, again, An African History of Africa. It's a whopper. It's a great book. A Tom Wolfian combination of reportage and history.
Thank you.
And it's out next week. Do go out and buy yourselves a copy. We'll be back on Monday. Until then, have a lovely weekend.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organisation, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimise the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saeeda Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim.
Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves.
The kind of things that people say don't touch,
yeah.
We are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itsinas.
I'm Kayla Itsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.